I'm Sterling Watts. I'm a happy alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm a member of the traditional group in Greenville, South Carolina, and we meet on Tuesdays and Fridays, and if you're ever in the area, you have a standing invitation to stop in and see us. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me to be part of this 29th Old Timers meeting. I'm always happy when I'm provided the opportunity to go anywhere and talk about what Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life, because it's done such a miraculous job. I spent most of my life, I was hunting for a substitute for alcohol. And I think that's why I'm here this morning. I found a substitute for alcohol here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hunted for years for a substitute. And when I got here, you told me for that substitute to work, I was going to have to do some things. You said I was going to have to go to meetings, get a home group, get a big book, get a sponsor, get into the big book, familiarize myself and put to work in my life the 12 steps and the principles I found there. And that if I did that, I would form a relationship with God as I understand Him, and I would not have to drink again. And I found that to be true. Because I did those things, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September the 25th, 1973. And for that, I'm very grateful. Now, but I told you I looked for these, that I was looking for substitutes. And so it's with great pleasure this morning that I tell you that I not only haven't had it necessary to take a drink since that day in September, but I haven't found it necessary to be analyzed, tranquilized, hypnotized, or baptized. One of the many, whichever, one of the fortunate, that Alcoholics Anonymous has done everything I needed for it to do. Now, we hear a lot today about problems other than alcohol. Oh, man, I had problems other than alcohol before I ever knew alcohol existed, never heard of alcohol. You see, I'm not only an alcoholic, I'm a hillbilly. And I'm the only son of a hillbilly school teacher. I was born in the middle of the Depression, and they named me Sterling Fletcher Watts III. I don't think I had a chance from the very get-go. You know, I was sitting here thinking this little building over here reminds me of my youth. Right from the very start, I just never seemed to have any identity as I saw it. My mother taught school for 40 years up in the mountains, and the first 18 years of my life, everywhere I went, I was known as Miss Kitty's little boy. And when I was 18, I went across the river and I married a prominent farmer's daughter. And overnight, I became Mac Jackson's son-in-law. And I came down to South Carolina to get rid of all that stuff, and I had one son. And he was quite a football player. He was All-State in high school, played in the Shrine Bowl, and then later played at Clemson. And when I got down to South Carolina, I became Waldo's daddy. And so you can see that when you let me here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I could stand up beside the podium and say, I'm Sterling Watts. Man, I thought I'd arrived, you know. It's necessary for me to tell you a little bit about how I got here. Now, I know a lot of you that's been just from Buford or just around close here in Atlanta, in the Atlanta area. You came up and knocked on the door and said, hey, I've been out drinking a while and I want to come in and get in the steps and get spiritual. I didn't get here exactly that way. I got here, I had a lot of help. I had a lot of help from state troopers and judges and preachers. But most of the help, most of my help came from Al-Anon. In fact, I say I came into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when I became powerless over Al-Anon. You see, she came into the program several months, a long time before I did, And so they knew her. And, you know, do y'all remember the first time that you've been sober long enough to ask you to read? Man, I never felt so important in my life. And I went back to the restroom and studied up. I didn't want to miss a word, you know. And I'm sitting there on the front seat that morning, and the chairman said in to read how it works, and he forgot my name and said, Nancy's husband. So... You see, and that's good for an alcoholic with an ego like I've got, because if I'm sitting in a meeting, maybe here in your group, and I get to thinking I am somebody and know something, somebody over there will call on old what's-his-name, and I need that, I need that. Lying has always been one of my problems, and I don't know exactly when I started lying. I started lying before I started remembering, I think, but anyway, and I was a little bit different kind of a liar. I just didn't lie and leave. I hung around and just kept lying till I made sure you understood what I was telling you, and you know, I'd lie about anything. You know, when I was 8 or 9 years old, about so big, I was raised in a fundamentalist home, and if you were going to eat any meals on Sunday, you had to learn Bible verse before you could partake of the meal on Sunday, and I was capable of memorizing Bible verses, but I took a lot of pleasure in making them up, and... And one of the ones I remember that I made up is, if a man goeth on a long journey and returneth not, he stayeth a long while. Now, the thing that I remember most about that is the old timers thumbing through the Bible trying to find that. That just made me feel warm all over. That really got me. Now, I was either blessed or I was penalized by having one sister 5 years older than I who was a perfect human being. She never told a lie. She never came home late. She never disobeyed an order. She made straight A's all the way through school, dean's list in college, nothing. And so... You know, she had completely cornered the market on being good. And I liked attention, and I think I saw if I was going to get any attention, it would have to be at getting good at being bad. I seemed to think that. But, you know, the first thing I remember as a kid, the first thing that comes back to me was, why can't you be like Elizabeth? Well, I didn't know why I couldn't be like Elizabeth. Wasn't sure I wanted to be like Elizabeth. But I know that this was just the start of me feeling less than. And in every endeavor from then on, I seemed to be able to figure out how I was less than. Drinking as a teenager was not a problem because my family was so well known there in the mountains. I know I tried it, but it just wasn't significant. But shortly after graduating from high school, I enlisted in service. And I had to go 55 miles away from home to be inducted into service, and that's the first time I'd ever been that far away from home without adult supervision. And that night I got drunk, I got sick, and I almost died. And to look a little bit about the ism of our alcohol problems, I have no problem in... the fact that there's a certain amount of insanity goes along with alcoholism, because 27 years later, three states away, I'm still drinking too much, I'm still getting sick, and I'm still almost dying. And it never dawned on me through these 27 years of drinking that really alcohol was my problem. It looked to me like to be a solution. And I remember... Everything in service. I was only in service. I enlisted for 18 months, and I only spent 13. And my drinking was so bad that they called me in and told me, said, look, if you'll just go back to Virginia and you leave right now, we'll give you an honorable discharge. But if you stay around, I'm afraid you're going to be in Leavenworth. That's how bad my drinking was. I came back from service, and industry had moved into the mountains while I'd been gone, and I got a job on the ground floor of the textile mill. I'm a few weeks, couple of months after I got back, I married my childhood sweetheart. A year later, my son came along. I used to think I was real popular, but I belonged to the Elks, the JCs, the Kiwanis, the VFW, the Moose, the Eagles. Really, I wasn't that popular. I was a joiner because I lived in a dry county, and most of these places serve booze. But I, and during this particular time, I was Sunday school superintendent of one of the largest Methodist churches in Pulaski, Virginia. And so things looked like they were working fine for me. And I remember in 1955, a group of us bought a strip of land and built homes like everybody was doing after World War II. And if you'd have looked at me, you would have... And talked to me, I would have said drinking was absolutely no problem whatsoever in my life. I worked hard, I worked long, I was very dependable, I got a lot of promotions. Life seems to be good. But when I had to look at my inventory from like 1948, let's say, to 1962, I was in five or six automobiles, totally lost. I was either driving or riding. Most of the time, we didn't have any idea who was driving or who was riding. One Thanksgiving day during that time, I had three accidents in the same day. That day, I hit the same man twice. Now, I didn't just hit him over on the other side of the parking lot. I hit him way over in the afternoon, 15 miles away from where I'd hit him that morning. And back in those days, you just called your insurance agent and you reported this accident. And I called my insurance agent, reported the accident, and he said a strange thing. He said, "Watts, how drunk are you?" I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, you reported that accident this morning." I said, "Man, I'm not drunk. I've hit him again, you know." I've always been unfortunate. I've kind of been a victim, you know. I'm not handy with tools. I don't know a screwdriver from a pair of pliers, and I'm just not a handyman. I love pretty yards, but I don't enjoy doing anything to get one. And in fact, I never did anything that got any points from lady folks. I did things like I like to lay out on the creek bank drunk, or play poker all night, or shoot pool, things like that. And the ladies just never gave me much. I don't think much. Any points for that kind of stuff. And so right away when we got, I told you we built those houses, and right away when I first got married, wherever we moved, and this is how I perceive things, wherever we moved, right across the street in front of me would have been the sign the next day that said Yard of the Month. And all I ever got was something like, you know, Wild Onion of the Decade. And there was handymen there that could fix anything. So as soon as we got married, it started, "Why can't you be like Tom and why can't you be like Bill?" Well, that didn't bother me because I'd been to boot school on "Why can't you be like Elizabeth," see? So I just accepted this. And we built those houses that I told you about in 1955, and they were supposed to be turnkey houses. But handymen didn't let this happen. Some of them started doing some things. Some of them putting on decks. Some of them putting in the furnace. Some of them putting the gutters on. All of them doing something. And I think this is the first time that I ever remember of experiencing impending doom. I'm sitting there and she's looking at me, "When are you going to do something?" You know. And now, you know, it's real funny. By this time, and I've met a lot of alcoholics that had a similar situation, if I didn't want to do something, I had assigned a certain amount of drink to it. I'm a kind of painter that I get the liquor at least twice before I get the drop cloth in the paint. if I had to trade cars, I didn't like trading cars. That took a pint. Borrow money from the banker, that took a fifth. I didn't get along with my sister. I called her my two-pint sister if she was coming to visit. And I'm sitting there this particular time, and my wife's gone up to her dad's. It's in July. My wife's gone up to her father's, and I used to drink. I don't know whether any of you did, but I drank I got real intelligent when I'd get to drinking. I just had that sixth sense. I noticed stuff, you know. And I noticed that nobody on that street had put in a mailbox. So I thought I'd get to jump on everybody. But now I never had put a mailbox in. So I didn't know how much booze to assign to this. But evidently I must have figured it out. I assigned a good bit of booze to this because it kind of turned into an alcoholic mailbox. I went down to the plant and I got the head engineer, and we got a 8-foot pipe 2.5 inches in diameter, and we got another pipe 1.5 inches in diameter, and put it down in that pipe, spot welded it all the way up, and I came back home and dug a 4-foot hole with steel reinforced concrete, went down to Sears and got the biggest mailbox they had. I put Sterling Fletcher Watts III on it, just like it might have been in old English letters, I don't know. And I brought that back and I tamped that concrete well, and I remember going in after I'd worked all day and drank some, and only drunks in here will know how this is. You know, when you just worked hard and drank a little and you just fall over into that beautiful slumber, you know that's going to happen. Just looking for the one, you know, and I thought to myself, gosh, she's going to be so proud of you when she gets back tomorrow. Next morning about 5:00, my phone rang. My neighbor, he said, Watts, what was wrong with you yesterday? I said, why? He said, you got that mailbox in facing your house. Now, about an hour to dig it up and turn it around. It looked like I'd built a small swimming pool and just left it out there in the out there in the thing. Now, I don't know whether we have any. Was anybody? I was a tavern drinker. I don't know whether a lot of you young people. I know we got a lot of newcomers here. Probably don't even know what a tavern is. But I was a tavern drinker, and I loved the taverns. I loved. The beautiful ladies that were there that would listen to your problems and really offer some answers, and you know, and they'd show you how to do the shuffleboard, and they were interested in things I was interested in, and I loved that country music, and my wife hated the whole drinking scene. She didn't like anything about drinking and made it known, and in fact, you know, from time to time I'd try to quit to get in some points and that kind of thing. And I remember one time she said, well, you almost stopped and got a beer. She knew when I was thinking about it, you know. So really, this marriage is not working at all, because everything I like she hates. And we had developed something along about this time. I called it... It's kind of a muscular chemical reaction. Every time I bent my muscle to take a chemical, her mouth flew open. I called that chin music. And that was the chinniest woman you ever saw in your life. And I just never did get to drink in peace. And by this time, I'd moved up in the plant, advanced to where I was buying a lot of equipment and a lot of chemicals and supplies, and the salesman called on me, and we drank a lot of liquor when they got into town, and they drank like I wished I could, and I watched them. They left home on Monday. They didn't go home till Friday. They had 5 days of hard drinking and no chin music. So I gave up the very best job I ever had. And I moved down to South Carolina to sell chemicals. Now, I know today that I moved down there to drink and to drink in peace. And I remember I went to work for a small chemical company out of Rhode Island. And the owner came down, and when he hired me, and he said, now, the people in the South don't know my company's name very well, and I'm going to give you some tools, and I expect you to get my name well known in the South. It said, I want you to give you this new Ford automobile and an unlimited expense account. And I want you to get my name known. Now, I know today that he meant where he had chemicals to sell. I got it everywhere. The judges, the jailers, the troopers, everybody had that company's name before I was through. I often thought maybe I ought to mention to him he owed me a bonus, but then after all the money I stole, I figured that wouldn't be a good idea. But things went pretty well. See, up in Virginia, I remember talking about feeling warm all over. Up in Virginia, you were limited to how much booze you could have in the car for how many people were riding there. And out in South Carolina, anything you could afford to buy, you could just load the whole car up. And I filled a trunk full of booze, and most of the textile mills that I called on were out in small outlying countries and counties. And incidentally, I traveled South Carolina, Georgia, and part of Alabama. But I drive into a finishing plant, and I'd get out and open up the trunk, and we'd have a few drinks right there in the parking lot, or we'd go around to the swimming hole or the fishing place or down at the golf course, just anywhere to have a drink. And we didn't have any mini bottles, or we didn't have any, everything was brown bagging, and they loved seeing me coming. I had one guy that was down in Abbeville. He said, "You know what, you called down here for 19 months, and we weren't sure what you were selling." Said, "We thought you might be a liquor salesman in the wrong place." They just didn't know. But I was real good. I was real good at what I did, and I prospered. I knew how to demonstrate my chemicals, and I had something that I met a lot of you other alcoholics since I've been here had the same condition. If I could keep my alcohol level just at the right place, I had a tremendous staying power. I could deal cards all night. I could take a shower, and I could play golf all day and take a shower and deal cards all night, that kind of thing. And they liked that. They said, "Oh, Sterl's a man's man." I'd hear them say things like, "Well, I'd rather ride with him drunk than I had Tom sober." And I'd just swell up and drink a pint and take them anywhere they wanted to go. I love for them to brag on how much I could drink. You know, somewhere along in here, and I don't know the time, she began to notice things, and she was getting me to go to an AA meeting now and then. I find some people where we went, but I think we might went to some automobile association meetings because she's sicker than I was. But anyway, while I was at one of these AA meetings, we met an old fellow there in Greenville. Some of you old timers might have known Squire Jones. And, you know, we have that sixth sense. I could see her eyes just sparkle when you heard Squire's name, and I just put his name in the back of my head for future use if I ever needed it. And one day I came home, and the chin music was unbearable. And I said, "Well, you mess with me, and I'll just call Squire Jones." She said, "Here's his number." She had it. She had it right there. So I called old Squire, and I told him I was ready to talk AA. And he got in his car and started to cross town. I got in my car and left town. He got over there, and he kind of 12-stepped Nancy. And I'm kind of glad he did. I know he told her a lot of his story, and she told him more of mine than she should have, that's for sure. But she evidently got across to him about how bad I was shaking. And by this time, I was shaking bad. I could thread a sewing machine, it running wide open, you know. What came out of this 12-step call was if I would drink a half a glass of K-Ro syrup or honey and put orange juice in it, I'd be all right. And so a ritual was I'd come in off the road about a third drunk, and she'd be standing there with this teaspoon, and she'd shove three or four tablespoons full of that honey or K-Ro down my throat, about like drenching a sheep. And then she'd give me this concoction, a half K-Ro and stuff to drink, and I'd drink it down. And by the time I got down in there where my vodka was hidden, I'd be all stuck together. I could hardly get a drink in, you know. So, It didn't take us long to realize AA wasn't working, and actually just making me the sweetest drunk in the South. I think it's a wonder to me that the fruit flies wasn't following me. I don't know, but that didn't slow her down. She ran into a fella who tried AA, and it had a job very similar to mine, and he tried AA and didn't work for him, and he'd gone on to a psychiatrist and he'd gotten all right. So over he comes and talks to me, and off I go to my first few sessions with the psychiatrist. Now, I have all the respect in the world for psychiatry. I have sponsored a couple of psychiatrists since I've been sober. But I can tell you this, I don't believe it doesn't do any good unless you need to be there and you want to be there. If you're in a psychiatrist's office because somebody sent you and you don't want to be there, and you're an alcoholic of my type, you'll drive him crazy. Had I not gotten away from that guy, he'd ended up in sanitarium. I can tell you that. No question about it. And I still got some Miss Kitty stories I never did even get to tell him. But anyhow, he said an interesting thing. He said, told my wife, said, the next time he acts up, said, I'm going to have to put him where he can be observed more closely. Well, now, acting up to him, I guess, meant get drunk. Because we only had one place, we didn't have a treatment center, we didn't have any detox in Greenville at the time. The only place we had to put a drunk was either in jail, and they didn't want you in jail, and the other place was a hospital for the emotionally disturbed. So I started going to the hospital for the emotionally disturbed. And now I've been over there 5 or 6 times. I've been over there in the trunk of a car. I've been over there in the back of a pickup truck. I've been over there in an ambulance. About any way you can get there. And every time I went, I was completely drunk. And if you look at my medical record, it says things like schizophrenia, paranoia, that kind of thing. It doesn't just say drunk, and I guess they didn't, with prices they were charging, they didn't want to put it down that way. I don't know. But I do know this, and what you hear now is my perception. I'm the kind of drunk that give me 2 or 3 shots of liquid Valium, and I'll just sleep 4 or 5 days and wake up, and I'm ready to go. And as I remembered, I came to over there, and I'm in occupational therapy. And I'm making leather watch bands and ceramic ashtrays. Now I'm talking quality stuff here. I really am. I got good at making these watch bands. It took about 3 hours for most of them down there to learn to make one watch band, and I'm making 3 in 1 hour. I'm turning those things out, pretty little watch bands. And if they hadn't run out of leather, I'd probably still be over there. I never felt so good in my life. I remember my wife came and she said, you know, the company's beginning to call. They suspect, they don't know where you are, what you're doing. You're liable to get fired. I said, don't worry about it. I can stay on down there as head therapist. I'm the best one in that class, you know. So, and they had another thing there. They called us clients, and there were about 20 of us to a group. And in my particular group, there was 19 women and me. And if you'd been good all week, the groups had been good, you got rewarded on Saturday. And somebody asked me, said, well, if you're in the hospital, how can you be bad? Well, at this particular hospital, they got a 60-foot fountain out front. I put a box of Tide in there. It had a snowball about as big as this building, and they considered that bad. So we didn't get anything that week. But this particular week, we'd been good. Nobody had been bad. And our reward was a field trip over to Kmart. And what that consisted of is you gathered up back in the lobby, and they gave you a peanut butter sandwich, and then you got to go over to Kmart. Sound real exciting, you know. And I remember he called me up to the side, and he said, now, most of these ladies smoke. All of them's taking electric shock treatment, and they're nervous. And that was being kind. And He said, they all smoke, and I can't let them have matches, so you're going to have to take the matches if they're going to smoke any on this field trip. And I remember leaving there, going down the steps, and I looked back at my little entourage. And, you know, I thought to myself, at last they found out, they really discovered my leadership abilities, you know. I kind of felt like I was graduating from officer's candidate school or something, you know. And to show you how sick I was, it was about 6 months or a year later that I realized what had really happened to me, that I was 44 years old and I'd worked my way up to keeper of the matches in a nut house. It's just what, it's about what I'd accomplished in those 44 years. I got out of there, and I'd always drink a half a pint. When I'd get out, I'd drink a half a pint and go home and share with her what I'd learned. And this one time she said, well, what you need rehabilitating, you've never tried rehabilitation. Well, we didn't want to miss anything, you know. So off I went down to the lower part of the state to a place called Palmetto Center. And it's a place, it's a rehabilitation center for the state sponsors it. And when I got there, I got the biggest resentment I've ever had. Now, I didn't know what a resentment was at that time, but I got mad about this. I was working, and I had no insurance, but I had a job. And it was going to cost me $600 to stay there for this 30 days. The rest of the people there were just wards of the state. They were all staying there for free. And I was really upset about that. Now, I'll get back to that. I think that's the first time that I think that $600 was when God really got to me about being a little bit honest about my condition I was in. But I remember they said that we don't sponsor AA, but we make a place for them to meet, and they come in on Thursday and share with us, and if you'd like to go over there, you know. And so I had nowhere else to go, and I went. And I thought, y'all sickest bunch of people I'd ever seen in my life. And here's what I heard, again, my perception. I heard a young man stand up behind a podium like this and say he couldn't take one drink without getting drunk. I never felt so sorry for anybody in my life. You know, as I saw this one drink drunk, I thought, well, I wrote his name down. If I knew I was going to look him up when I got out of there, and I knew if I could keep him buying, I could keep him going for 3 or 4 weeks anyhow. I could manage that. Well, when I left there, they told me, said, go back to Greenville and don't drink, and we think you'll be all right. Well, I suspected that by this time I was beginning to suspect alcohol as my problem. And I remember going up the road, and I thought, well, I'm going to do that. I'm going back to Greenville and do just exactly what they tell me to do. And it ain't going to work, and I'm going to sue them and get my $600 back, you know. So I did. I went back to Greenville, and I did just exactly what they said do. They said, don't drink. Well, I didn't drink. Now, there's some newcomers here, and you might be thinking about what I was thinking at the time. I just thought I could quit drinking, and nothing would happen. I'd just be all right. Well, if you're an alcoholic of my type, it doesn't work that way. I put nothing else in there, no program, no God, no nothing. I just dumped that alcohol in and took the alcohol out and didn't realize what alcohol had been doing for me all those years. I still had those raw nerves and everything in there, and I've never been as miserable in my life. I hated, this was a few months, I hated everybody and everything. I hated you if you could drink and not get in trouble. And I hated you if you could not drink and have fun. I got a glass about so big and filled it full of tea, and everywhere I went, I said, look at me, poor little old thing, 45 years old and never drink again. I said things like, let's get our milk and cookies and go to bed. I thought life was over without booze, you know. Well, I did drink again. I tell you, had I not gotten drunk, I think I'd have had to commit suicide. It got to that point, and I, with that attitude, because I put nothing else in there. I did drink again, and it started several months of just zombolic drinking. I was a zombie. I didn't know where I was going, what I was doing, or anything else. And I came home from I came home from down in Augusta, Georgia, sometime in September, and I went back into what Nancy referred to as my rat hole. And I don't know how long I stayed back there, but I never want to forget the condition I was in when I came to or whatever I did. I'd been in there several days, and those of you that have been drunk, you know what a drunken liar tastes, smells like. It was awful, and I my legs were rubbery, and I had to crawl to the bathroom, and it was just a miserable situation. And I'd take a drink and spit it up, and take a drink, and finally I got a drink down, and then I got another drink down, and I got another drink down, and nothing's happening. Wasn't doing anything for me. An alcoholic quit working, evidently, and it scared me to death. I didn't know what to do. An alcoholic of my with what all was going on in my head and with me and my body and so forth, when liquor wasn't working, I didn't know what to do, and I just dropped my head over in my hands, and I said something like, "My God, nobody knows." She said, "Yeah, somebody might know, AA might know," and she got me dressed that night, and we went to an AA meet. I don't remember anything particularly that went on in that AA meeting. I just know that on the way home, in Greenville, we have a desire chip. And she said to me, "You didn't take a desire chip." I said, "No. If I don't get a drink down tonight, I'll die." And I think that's the first time I ever really got honest with myself about maybe not drinking. And I did come home that night, and I'd get a drink down, and he'd come back, and then I finally got a drink or two down. And for all intents and purposes, my dry date is September the 23rd. But I wait 2 days to celebrate my dry date, which is the 25th. To me, that's a God thing. I don't know why I did it. I have no idea. I know I was too sick to think about why I would do that. But I think that God knew that if sometime in the future I'd been sitting around a table of alcoholics thinking to myself, "I'm telling them a 23rd and I'm not sure that's a good dry date, and I had you all fooled, that I probably would have lost respect for you and might not have never made it." Now, but for whatever reason, I do wait that 2 extra days till September the 25th. Now, this is the part of my talk that I hope to have your attention for, because if you had told me that I would be standing in Atlanta, Georgia, in 2010, as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and having lived as long as I have, reasonably happy, joyous, and free, I wouldn't have believed you. And I believe that the freedom I found from alcohol is one of the greatest things that's ever happened in my life. And I believe that I am happy, joyous, and free today because to this minute, right now, there is not one thing that I know of that's gone on in my life that I have not talked to God as I understand Him about, or another alcoholic. And that gives me complete freedom. I wouldn't take anything in the world for it. And, I consider this sobriety a gift. It's a gift from God as I understand Him. I don't know why I have it. People are going to die in Georgia. They're going to die in South Carolina and all over the world. They'll die today. They'll die today from drinking. And in fact, I have had people in my peers that came along. They had the same sponsor I had. They were same home group. They were subjected to the same 164 pages, the same 12 steps, everything. And they died drunk. So I don't know why I have this gift. I just know that I do feel like it's a gift, and I feel like that to enjoy this gift, when you have a gift of this magnitude, I'm sure there's some responsibility that comes with it. You just don't accept it and do nothing. I feel like I have a lot of responsibilities. One of the responsibilities I have is being a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When the other, when a drinking alcoholic comes in the door, as I was, I have the responsibility to get him by the hand and take him through this 164 pages. I have the right to lead him through the steps and to show him how I found a higher power that was able to keep me sober. And I believe that you know, to keep this thing going, I have to do just exactly what the old timers did to me. They took me through the 164 pages. They didn't try to add to it. They didn't try to take away from it. They just presented it. It was presented somewhat 75 or so years ago, and nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. To me, that means it's absolutely God inspired. And they said I had to do some things. Now, everything I did in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't do everything exactly right. They said get a sponsor. I had talked to an old man there in our group, and he'd been sober, he said, 29 years. And I talked to him, and he'd been a bare-knuckle fighter in the CBs, and he drank liquor like I did, and I knew he hadn't been sober 29 years. And if he could make y'all believe that lie, I wanted what he had. I talked to him. And another reason I liked him, they paid a lot of attention to him. You know, wherever he went, people were up shaking their hands and this, that, and the other. And I got to be a focal point. I remember we'd go out of town and he'd speak. I'd drive him. And when the meeting was over, whoever picked up a white chip or a 30-day chip or a 90-day chip or something, I'd go up and put my arm around him. I'd say, boy, you keep coming back. This thing really works. Between me and that speaker up there, we got nearly 30 years in this thing, you know. And the one thing that they told me to do, there's two things they told me to do, 1,000 things they told me to do, but the two main things that they said do that I think were absolutely necessary for me to maintain any kind of sobriety, and I pass this along to everybody I sponsor, that they must get a home group and they must go to meetings. And I do that because I can give you a list of things a mile long that those two things have saved for me. For instance, I had always been a drunk. When I got into any kind of an organization, I looked at the rules. I learned early on that if you break the rules, there are consequences. But if you learned how to circumvent them, or if you learn where the loopholes are, then you can talk your way out of most things. So I've been sitting in this home group, and we had a little old lady there that she had been sober longer than dirt, and she knew questions. She had answers to questions I never was going to answer. But anyway, she'd give me her number. She'd say, son, you call me before you take a drink. I'd say, you gave me that Tuesday. Well, you may have lost it. Take my number. Well, I'd been out on the road traveling, and the customers hadn't done what they were supposed to do, and life's just bad, and I'd called home, and the chin music was going. And so I knew it was going to be bad, and I had 7 liquor stores to pass before I got to my house, so I stopped out on the interstate at the rest area, and I called Taylor, and I said, old woman, you told me to call you before I took a drink, and I explained all this stuff to her. She said, no problem. Said, go out and stand in the median and strip off naked and they'll take you to jail. Now, you know, I said, well, that woman's crazy. And I hung that phone up and I rushed right by every one of those. She'd insulted my intelligence, I can tell you. So, you know, that's just because she had been sitting in the home group observing what I was saying and what she knew I was doing. And I consider her, she saved my slip. Now, we know tonight which, but I used to think she saved my slip. A lot of people have saved the slip from me. Now, I was a slip planner. I don't know whether y'all ever planned slips. I hear people say, oh, they just slipped up and drank. I planned them. And I remember one night I'm sitting there in a meeting on the front row, and it dawned on me I never had any light beer. They didn't have light beer when I got sober. And I thought, well, hey, I know where the cold beer is. I'll go in the morning and I'll have light beer. And I had that mug sitting up on my head with all the frost running down it. I wasn't hearing what the speaker said or anything. And when they gave out the chips, old Sam got a chip. He got a white chip. Now, he'd been sober about as long as I had, about 9 months. And I went up, and he looked like he'd been run over by a Mack truck. And I said, Sam, what happened? He said, Wednesday, a week ago, I started drinking light beer. And I said, well, strike plan A, you know. And so by going to meetings and by having a home group, the slips kept getting stolen, and that's why I'm able to be here today. They kept stealing my slips. Now, my sponsor got me by the hand, and he took me through the steps. And, you know, I learned a lot in the steps. I learned a lot about trust. I learned a lot about honesty. But the main thing I learned about was me. And I didn't know that I was what I didn't know anything about. I didn't know what my limitations were, what my capabilities were. I missed out on half a life if I wanted to look back on it, because I wouldn't try something if I didn't think I could be the very best. And so I learned through those steps and with the loving sponsor that all I have to do today, even though I'm not a very talented person, is to take the talents that I have and do the very best I can do with them on a daily basis. And that's all I have to do. And I do that, and if you don't like it or I don't fit in, so I'll fit in somewhere. But my life's going to be a whole lot better. My life's a whole lot better now that I know what assignment God means for me to have. And I'd been sober about 7 or 8 years, and I'd held every office you could hold in a group, and I'd held state a couple offices at the state. And yet I knew, if you'd looked at me, you'd have thought I was an AA poster child, you know. But I knew that I didn't have what some of you had. And I went to my sponsor. You know, I could just tell in your face that you were more relaxed. You're just more serene than I was. You weren't uptight. And I asked Jim, I said, Jim, what do you think the problem is? What have I missed? He said, well, why don't you get back in the big book and see if you've missed something? Just get back in there and study it. Now, by this time, I'd been to two or three Charlie and Joe's tape studies. I'd been through the big book every Thursday night for 3 years. But I had never gotten back in the big book just to study it as a textbook to find something that would make my life better. And I found so many things in there, a couple of them I'll run through right quick. First of all, I had the doctor's opinion. It says in there, and I'll paraphrase, Dr. Silkworth said that these men had to have a profound belief in a higher power if they were going to recreate their life. Well, recreating life was not what I thought about. I thought about not drinking. I thought about doing the next best thing. But recreating life sounded pretty serious to me. And I knew right then that I was going to have a profound belief in a God as I understand him if I were ever going to recreate my life. Over to the end of chapter 4, it said God would disclose himself if I drew near to him. That made sense. And so I set out on a deal of trying to find out where I could get to feel like I was the closest to God. I tried many things. The thing I found out that today, the closest I can get to God as I understand him is right here in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I can't get any closer. That's just me. I contend to this day, and there have been times when I've had a message. I got to message. Any message I ever had, I feel like I got from God, I got from another alcoholic. And, you know, they'll say to me, do you have to still go to those meetings? I say, yeah, I'm just checking in down there to get my messages, you know. And, you know, if I'm out on the road and I don't get to a few meetings, I can tell when I've missed my messages, too, I can tell you. And it says another interesting thing. You know, that's pretty easy. It says if you draw near to him, he'll disclose himself to you. And that sounds pretty simple. Doesn't have not a lot of work that I have to do. It's like I could just come into AA, and if I feel like I'm close, I just sit here. Just 4 or 5 pages over, it says, that he would disclose, if you drew near to him and performed his work well, he would provide everything you needed. So that performing his work well meant that I had work to do. And I have since then, to the best of my knowledge, tried to on a daily basis. One of my prayers is, God, if you got anything human to be done today, let me be spiritual enough to do it. Sometimes I feel like I am, sometimes I feel like I'm not. But I have successfully done what the book told me. In the morning, the first thing, I just ask God to direct my thinking. And then it says, relax and take it easy. And, you know, I sponsored an old boy one time, and I pointed that out to him. And he didn't work again for 5 years, where it said, relax and take it easy. But anyway, So I know that I have to do the next right thing. And I live my life today by the 11th step. And that step tells me exactly what to pray for. All I need to pray for is God's will for me. And then after I know what God's will is for me, it tells me more than likely I'm not going to want to do it. And that's so true. That's so true. And when I get to the point where I don't want to do the next right thing, I need to pray for willingness to carry out his power. And so I call that my walking around step. My walking around step today is my 11th step. I'm the kind of alcoholic that I never could deal with death. When somebody died that was close to me, all I knew to do was to get drunk. When my daddy died, I got drunk. My mother died, I got drunk. All those times I made a complete ass out of myself. I spent a long time having to make amends for the things that went on then. When I was just getting drunk, and I'd been sober about 10 years, and my wife of 35 years, and my Al-Anon of 10 dropped dead very suddenly. And 3 months later, my sponsor died. 6 months later, my sister died. I'd have never gotten through any of this if it hadn't been for what I had been shown to do by the old timers. And nobody told me this. They never had a workshop on it. They just showed me. And I watched the old timers. I'd see them showing up at a meeting they might not have been to. They were doing things in AA that was out of their norm. And I'd ask them, and they'd had some trauma in their life. Son killed on a motorcycle or something, when I'd ask them. And so right away when this happened, they had showed me that, and this is the first real trauma that had happened to me, was when my wife died. And I got right in the middle of AA. And when my sponsor died, I just tripled up on my AA meetings. And it worked. And, you know, I'd been sober, I guess I'd been... about a year and a half, I began to get very lonely. I got very lonely. And because I'd tripled up on my AA meetings, I met a lady in AA, a lady named Donna. And we were married for 20 years. And it was a great experience. And I was in 2003, I was up in Virginia on an AA golf outing. And I got a call that told me that Donna had a hemorrhage and had passed away. And so I had to rush back to Greenville. And I remember coming down from the mountains up in Virginia, and I'm asking myself, God, what lesson am I supposed to learn from this? If this is a learning opportunity, which I think it is, please let me know what I'm supposed to learn from this. And I never once got bitter about it when I looked at it that way. And I've never been as grateful for being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous or being married to another active member of Alcoholics Anonymous as I was that night at the funeral home. And the line was long. You all are so great to come. And the line was long, people to convey their condolences, but the people that walked up weren't just people to come and share with me. They were stories. They were stories of families put back together, mother and fathers that had found children, marriages put back together. All these things were stories, and I Standing there, as bad as it was, I never have been as thankful as I was that night for not only have been an active member, but being married to an active member. I tell you, when you're an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's very, very rewarding. I can tell you, I was telling Rebecca, I told you I like speaker meetings, and I've learned so much at speaker meetings, and I think this is where we identify. And I was at a meeting one time. I'm about 9 months sober at this time, I think, and this lady from California was speaking, and she was saying that she was about 9 months sober, and she just said, "Is this all there is to it? I'll just get drunk." And she went down to the liquor store and picked up a pint, and she got up to pay for it, and she had to write a check, and she said, "What is today?" And they told her. She said, "My God, I'm cookie lady at home group tonight." She went and put the pint up, and she's 20-some years sober. Now, that made sense to me. That made sense to me. And since then, I have always had some kind of obligation to perform on a weekly basis as Alcoholics Anonymous. I call it my cookie lady sobriety, and it works for me. I told you that I didn't know how to handle death, and after Donna died, again, I got real lonesome. And about a year and a half later, I met a lady in AA. Her name's Judy, and Judy's 10 years sober, and I'm 37 years sober, and we're doing a great job at this relationship. She's got her program. I got my program. It's necessary. And we've developed a program together, and it's working real well. Now, if you think about how good God's been to this alcoholic, as we know, alcoholics in general have problems with relationships. Now, I had 10 years with an Al-Anon. I had 20 years with an Alcoholics Anonymous member, and I've got another 5 years with an Alcoholics Anonymous member. And they've all been great. And I contend it's because we put God and Alcoholics Anonymous before anything else. And I kindly suggested that before I ever asked one of these ladies to make me a permanent relationship. And so every morning we read and pray together, and every night we thank Him for what we received that day together. And during that morning, we invite God into the marriage to be with us that day. And when you do that, you know, sometimes when you get a little bit feisty and you get a little tension and your neck sticks out and all this kind of stuff, my second wife would say, "Whoa, I'm Donna, I'm an alcoholic," you know. It's God's been good to me. I told you about that one son I had, and he had two children. And these grandchildren are grown now. One of them's 31, one of them's 29. And neither one of them's ever seen their grandfather take a drink. If I never get another reward out of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's enough. That's enough. If nothing else happens, all the other rewards I have are too numerous to mention, but that I consider great. And that little girl asked me if I would come over to her school and speak to her class about alcoholism. She's a teacher. And I went over there, and I'm standing out there in the lobby waiting on Allison, and this little old gray-headed principal walked up and looked at me right in the eye. She said, "Are you Allison's grandfather?" Now, I don't think I'm ever going to know who I am. But I'm thankful I know what I am. I'm a real alcoholic. It's time to substitute for alcohol. Thank you for letting me tell you about it.